Okay, we're going to go ahead and call the House Finance meeting to order. With us today is Representative Foster, Co-Chairman Schnault, Co-Chairman Meyer, Representative and Vice Chairman Stokes, Representative Hawker, Representative Weirach, and also joining us today is Representative Gatto. Welcome. The time is 12:30. And on today's schedule, we have SB 48, Psychological Evaluation, SB 206, Detention, ID of Persons, Contempt of Court, House Bill 316, Extending the Board of Governors, Senate Bill 231, which is the capital budget. So we will take them in that order. Also, Representative Petula has joined us, and Representative Holm. Also, you may want to turn off your cell phones. Thanks to Representative Bramhurst, we have donuts back there for you to enjoy. And if you want to bring us donuts tomorrow, then you can leave your cell phones on, I guess. Okay, with that, if Representative Foster?
Yeah, can we do the SB 48 last? No, I'm just kidding.
I don't think Senator Betty Davis would like that. Senator Davis, you want to come to the table, please? Speaker Harris is here. Representative Moses is here. I'm turning the floor over to you, ma'am.
All right, thank you. Thank you, committee, for listening to my bill in such a timely manner. And we'll be very brief, and I'm ready to ask a question. I think we have somebody here from DED that will speak to the indeterminate note. It's non-zero. And I'll just let Richard give an overview of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Benavides, the staff for Senator Davis, who's the sponsor of Senate Bill 48. In its simplest terms, this bill basically states that a public school may not deny any student access to programs or services simply because the parent of that student has refused to place the student on psychotropic medications, get a psychiatric evaluation, or seek psychiatric or psychological treatment for the child. It spells out what communications are allowed, who can do these types of evaluations, and the protections a parent or guardian has against being reported to OCS simply because they disagree with the psychotropic medications. The 2004 reauthorization of the IEDA law requires that each state has to prohibit state and school district personnel from requiring a child to obtain a prescription of a substance covered by the Controlled Substances Act as a condition of attending school, receiving services, or receiving an evaluation for a disability. Now, this prohibition does not prevent teachers or other school personnel from consulting or sharing classroom-based observations with parents or guardians about a student's academic or functional behavioral performances or behavior in the classroom or school or the need for evaluation for special education or related services. And we've adopted that stance here in SB 48 in order to clarify that public school teachers and school district personnel may share those observations with a parent and may offer program options and other assistance to the parent, but they still may not compel any specific action by the parent or require that the student take medication. Essentially, Senator Davis feels that any medical decision made to address a student's needs is a matter between the student's parent, and a competent health care professional chosen by the parent. And with that, we would ask for your vote for this bill. Thank you.
Any questions? Seeing none, is there anybody here from the public that would like to testify? Are you going to have one of the departments come up to speak to the indeterminate fiscal note?
Yes, if I could have Barb Thompson okay. From BBB.
Barbara?
My name is Barbara Thompson. I'm the director of the Division of Teaching and Learning Support for the Department of Education. Our fiscal note, we did revise the other day to clearly reflect that it is a zero fiscal note for the department. Previous language had said indeterminate for school districts. We did not know if the bill would have had any impact on school districts, but it always was intended to be zero for the department.
And why would you think that there would be a fiscal note for school districts?
meeting, we, when the bill came out, we hadn't heard from any school districts. We didn't know if any districts would have to change any policies or change any staffing patterns to comply with the bill, but we've heard nothing from districts that would indicate that this would be the case.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Senator Davis, for any at the table. Are there any litigations or involving required use of this that this bill would affect? Any legal action against school districts brought by parents or anybody else that you're aware of?
Are you referring to our state or
our state? Well, no. Our state particularly, and that affects our district.
None that I'm aware of, but the state.
And has it, Mr. Chairman, if I might, has it been an issue that's, you referenced outside of the state, has this been an issue that's, I just read something, it was something about a bar association suing a guy who had an autistic son about his status in the school, and the guy had done pro se, and I was wondering if that was involved, use of drugs or not.
No, it was not. This bill has been around for two sessions. There's at least 30-some states that have introduced or passed legislation in this light. The federal government has already said that it's not legal to insist that a child have drugs in order to go to school. And so that will come down to all the states eventually would have to have some kind of a statute to cover that.
To the fiscal notes, sir, thank you. Again, this indeterminate, just to clarify from my own understanding, it is indeterminate, and I think I make sure that I, you know, sometimes indeterminate means it's a big number, but we don't know how big, and sometimes indeterminate means we don't know if it's going to have any effect, most likely a small one, if any. And would it be correct to really characterize this as probably a small one, if any, but we just don't know?
Representative Hawker, we have not heard that there would be a fiscal impact. Districts, definitely not with the department. Again, at the beginning when the bill first came out, we didn't know. We've not heard anything from any districts that there would be a fiscal impact.
Thank you.
Has any district contacted you about concerns about let's say there is a child that may or may not be on medication, but maybe they were on medication and they weren't. There wasn't a problem there, but because their parents wanted them off of the medication, that there became a problem at school, and maybe there was an endangerment of other kids at school. Senator.
I was thinking that you were speaking to the department because I already stated that there's no cases that I know of.
Okay. Okay. Representative Couture?
Just real quickly, so the original language is that unless you're otherwise authorized by law, the school personnel can't do a number of things. But there's any other law that authorizes it then would quickly come into place, and I'm sure there are many that do authorize it. And I just wanted to kind of get your feeling then. So when you go into where the communications are not prohibited, it's 1430, 172, and then down to 1A, it turns a little circular because it first says that you can consult or share the observations, and then it goes right back to say, but you can't do it if it violates that first prohibition. So it's a little bit circular, but I think the intent is absolutely if there's some other reason that it's absolutely allowed. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Couture, that's correct.
And great, thanks.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Senator. Thank you, Barbara. I guess I'll ask again, is there anybody from the public that would like to testify? Is there anybody online? We'll go to public testimony online.
Richard Warner.
Oh, okay. Richard Warner, are you online, Commissioner?
Yes, sir, I am.
Did you have some comments regarding SB 48?
No. Yes, I would like to say a couple things.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Yes, sir. For the record, my name is Richard Warner. I'm the president of the Seattle chapter of the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. Our territory covers Washington and Alaska and Montana and Idaho. And we've been involved in similar legislation in a number of other states. I'd first of all just like to say that Senator Davis and her staff have really gone to great lengths over the past several years to get the input of everyone concerned with this issue and to craft legislation that meets the needs of all the stakeholders, and we think they've done an extraordinary job on that, and I think that's an important point to consider. Secondly, I'd like to focus my testimony on a couple of basics related to this area of psychiatric testing and drugging. Psychiatric conditions are disorders. They're not diseases or illnesses. In medicine, you have strict criteria for calling a condition a disease. You have to have a predictable group of symptoms, and the cause of the symptoms or an understanding of their physiology must be proven or established. Malaria and typhoid fever, for example, are diseases. In the absence of a known physical cause, you have a group of symptoms that you might appear in many different patients. You need to consider that a disorder or a syndrome. Harvard Medical School psychiatrist Joseph Glenn Mullen has said that in psychiatry, all of its diagnoses are merely syndromes, cluster of symptoms presumed related to each other, but not diseases. So claims that the conditions which psychiatrists call disorders are equivalent to diseases like diabetes are false, and they're not backed up by medical science. So we're not talking about something that would be equivalent to a parent preventing their child, for example, from getting insulin treatment for diabetes or getting treatment for cancer. So what we're really dealing with here is opinion. Whether or not a particular psychiatric label is attached to a child is a matter of opinion. And in fact, it's not even very reliable opinion. All the studies of psychiatric reliability show that psychiatrists frequently disagree about their diagnoses. And in fact, there was a National Institute of Health consensus conference on attention deficit hyperactivity disorder a few years back, where they concluded that not only is there no valid diagnosis for it, but there's no evidence that these children have anything abnormal about their brains. So I think we need to be focused in on protecting parents who are informed about what's going on from a school district forcing their child to take a drug based on no valid diagnosis, no evidence that there's anything wrong with the child's brain. There's no blood test, medical test that can show that. The president of the American Psychiatric Association admitted that last year. We don't have a test for that. To make matters worse, the Food and Drug Administration has come out with warning after warning over the last few years, saying that these drugs can double the risk of a child becoming suicidal, that they increase the risk of cardiovascular problems and sudden death, that they cause psychiatric events such as suicidal ideation, hallucinations, aggression, violent psychotic behavior. So that's why so many states around the country have passed these laws. They recognize that an informed parent, indeed an informed doctor, can have very good reasons for saying, I don't want my child to be subjected to an unreliable psychiatric test or put on a drug for no medical reason that can double their risk of killing themselves and increase their risk of cardiovascular problems. And I think that's essentially what we're trying to protect with legislation like this. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions of Mr. Warner? Seeing none, thank you, Richard, for your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Next, we'll move on to Tom Swanson in Anchorage. Mr. Swanson, are you with us?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, we sure can. Go ahead.
Good. I work construction, and my wife is a teacher. And if I mess up in a half an hour in construction work, I am out of a job. But if a teacher has tenure they have no responsibility to anyone that they have to answer to. So one of the big problems that teachers have in that particular case, from my observation, and that's strictly a non-professional observation, is that they are looking for ways to bypass having to use understanding and care and compassion to handle children rather than just to be happily tenured and not be bothered. And so I think any teacher who would actually want to keep the rights that this bill would cut down on, is my understanding, they would be lazy and not doing their job. And so I would like to see teachers be held responsible and accountable more than they are, and to actually do their job instead of hide behind some psychiatric drug. And that's basically all I have to say.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Swanson. Are there any questions of Mr. Swanson? Seeing none, thank you, sir, for your testimony. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify? If not, we'll close public testimony.
Welcome
on. The teacher has tenure. One guy.
We will move on to amendments. I don't see any amendments at this time. I would like to adopt a new Department of Education and Early Development fiscal note dated 5-06 of 06 in lieu of an indeterminate note.
You're actually looking at something else that was so solid on this bill, Mr. Chairman. Let's see, Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the new fiscal note.
Yes, the new one. It's right here.
5606, Department of Education and Development.
That's the new zero fiscal note. The new zero fiscal note to replace the independent.
I had it already.
Is there any objection to adopting the new fiscal note in lieu of the indeterminate? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Is there any other comments on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I just had one question. There appears to be an education bill. Did the National Education Association representing teachers have any position? Because I don't see them in the room, and so it's.
They are in the room, but.
I'm not trying to find them up.
Okay. Good. No problem. All right. Representative Foster.
Yes, sir. I wanted to thank Senator Davis for all of the hard work she's done on this, and Richard, thank you very much. I'll go ahead and move SB 48 out of Finance Committee with individual recommendations with the revised fiscal note. Yeah.
Any objections? Seeing none, bills moved out of committee. Thank you, Senator Davis, for gracing us with your presence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You too, Richard.
Betty, thank you very much. Good bill.
Thank you.
Next, we will move on to a CS for SB 206 Judiciary Detention / ID of Persons / Contempt of Court. First, I'd like to make a motion to adopt the Bank Committee Substitute, version 24-LS1197/N, lookup, dated 5-06 of 06, as a working document before the committee. Schultz, can I get you to make that motion?
Yes, I make that motion, Chairman. We're looking for no objection.
I don't objection.
We're not objecting.
There's no objections. We have SB for.
I thought I was just getting past notes today.
I'll try to slow down on my notes, though. We have the Blank Committee Substitute version in front of us.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you for letting me come in out of the rain.
Rogers.
Thank you. Committee members, Senate Bill 206 is an attempt to deal with what's a growing problem in Anchorage, and I'm afraid will migrate to other parts of the state. Some of you may be aware of what happened last fall when there was a gang shooting at a mall in Anchorage, and the police tried to detain some of the people that were involved in that event to question them, to ask them for their ID, and they both basically flipped the cops off and said, see you, we're out of here. I was a little surprised at that, and I was even bigger, had an even bigger surprise when I realized that Alaska doesn't have any kind of a material witness bill. And that's what this bill brings before you. Just a tool by the police to be able to get people to identify themselves so that they can, whether they're a participant in a problem or not, lead to some assistance in their investigation. It is, like many bills in this area, a balance, trying to protect the individual freedoms of regular citizens, but still a lot, helping the police in their ability to prosecute crimes and helping defendants obtain witnesses that could appear on their behalf. We have had chiefs of police testify in support of this. It's been an interesting challenge to maintain the constitutionality and the rights of individual and the tools the police need. The chief in Anchorage is supportive of this, and I might just share a little. I didn't ask him to be available today. He has some other demands on his time, but if I could share an anecdote, the story that he mentioned about why it's so important to be able to identify people, even if they aren't an active participant in a crime. Many of you probably remember the Meech murder, Rush and Jack Springs in Anchorage. Five teenagers were had some camp out adventure, and Charles Meech came along and killed them all. After the call came in that there had been a shooting, and there was a brown van seen in the neighborhood, and it was driving away when the cops stopped, then they said, hi, who are you? Did I see your ID? And the guy said, sure, here it is. And it turns out he wasn't involved in the shooting. And the fellow was let go and went on his way with just a momentary detention while I showed his ID. As the investigation unfolded, they didn't have any leads. They just didn't know what was going on. So they went back, and now because he had identified himself, he was in the report, they could go back and they could talk with him further. And it turns out, a rather interesting story, the fellow was a bicycle aficionado. He was just very, very interested in bicycles, and he had some expertise in bicycles. And he was walking through the park, came upon this bicycle sitting beside the trail. It was a very unique bike. And he knew his unique bike, so it was a very expensive bike. And he told the police, he said, I probably shouldn't mention this, but I was thinking about taking the bike. And I heard the shots, and I left. Well, the police were able to use this information, just a casual observation that really wasn't related to any crime, find out there are only 12 bikes like this sold in Anchorage in the last several years, and one of them was sold to Charles Meech, and that was what unraveled this case. So what we're looking at here is allowing the police to require people to identify themselves when they have a likely reason to believe that there has been a crime occurring in the neighborhood. It does, however, protect material witnesses from unreasonable arrest or confinement, but does, as I point out, make them available for further testimony if necessary. Another thing the police have mentioned is, particularly in these gang-related incidents, if they were to volunteer information, they may put their life in danger or certainly put themselves in jeopardy. With this bill, the police are going to require them to identify themselves and then
the police can later say, we want to talk to you, and the witness slash participant can say, hey, I didn't want to talk to cops. They need me. The law requires that I do. So, you know, don't beat me up because I participated in this investigation. I've just closed with saying, again, I believe it's a fair balance. It is something that the police would like to use, and I believe that it will help solve crimes in Alaska and encourage your support.
Any questions from committee members? Representative Parker.
Chairman, thank you, and Senator, always a pleasure to see you. We just passed a CS out into here as opposed to your previous version. Do you have any issues with the CS, or do you support the CS?
I support the CS.
Thank you.
Representative Cotullo.
Can you tell me the differences between the CS and the bill? It looks like you've taken out the ability of a person to move to quash a subpoena. Is that the only difference, and why would you do that?
Lauren was working on it, so if I could refer to Lauren.
For the record, my name is Lauren Rice, staff to Senator Bundy through the chair, Representative Cotullo. We took out that section, and Dean Guinan with the Department of Law can offer more information, but the main reason was it implied that if a person then offered their identification, there would be no other reason to have a subpoena after them, and the cops could not get further information and could not ask for more testimony. And so we took that out to ensure that even if they offer ID, they can request that the subpoena be dropped, but if the cops decide that there's more information needed, the individual can still be served and required to comply with the subpoena.
Maybe we could have Mr. Guinelli come up, because it looks to me like, I mean, they've already got the fingerprints, they've got everything, and maybe I'm misunderstanding, because this looks like a normal, you know, you have a normal right to move the court to quash if you feel there's some reason for it, and then the court could decide. I mean, if it's some kind of an automatic thing, maybe that's different. I just didn't read it that way.
Mr. Guinelli?
Through the chair, for the record, Dean Guinelli, Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Representative Cotullo, I think we've got to start with the proposition that it's the obligation of every citizen to provide testimony in court if they are lawfully subpoenaed to do so. And certainly, as you indicated, there may be a number of reasons why that person has a privilege not to testify. For example, if they would incriminate themselves, they can always go to court and ask that they not be required to testify. In fact, there's a specific statutory scheme that covers Fifth Amendment claims. What this bill attempts to do is to provide a mechanism for identifying people who are witnesses to serious crimes, and it does that in a variety of ways. One of the ways is to, if they don't have identification or refuse to provide identification, give them a subpoena to testify in front of the grand jury, and they have an obligation to do that. There may be independent reasons for wanting that person to testify in addition to just identifying them. In other words, in addition to finding out who they are, their true name, the prosecutor who's presenting that case to the grand jury may very well need their testimony, may know that person has information and wants that testimony. And what this particular provision allowed is if you go ahead, okay, I've been served with a subpoena, I'm gonna show my ID, I'm gonna tell them who I am, and I ask the DA to quash the subpoena. But if the prosecutor has an independent need for that witness's testimony, that person ought not to be able to move to quash the subpoena on that basis. And the way I was reading this is that it would have allowed the person to quash the subpoena to avoid their obligation testifying from the grand jury, simply by showing their driver's license. As I said, if there is any other independent reason for moving to quash the subpoena, they can certainly do that, and I don't think we need to say that in here, but allowing them to go to court to get that done simply by showing their driver's license, I think, is contrary to what we want, which is for grand juries to make decisions based on the best available evidence.
Representative Stoltz?
Only if she's still going.
Representative Perdue?
Well, I hear what you're saying, and my fear, of course, is that, you know, it would be some kind of a blanket denial of the right to quash for other reasons. I hear you're saying that's not the intent. So I guess what I'm going to just have to think of, because we've probably got a little bit of time between here and now, is talk with you and the sponsor and see if that language really does accomplish what you're trying to do, so that it doesn't do the broad, you know. I mean, you can't anyway because of the Fifth Amendment, but just to be careful about that. The second question I had, but I'd yield to Representative Stoltz because it's a different line of thinking. Go ahead. Okay, the second line is, I honor the intent of trying to keep the witnesses at the scene, but the language is pretty broad to me when you're saying that the person was in the vicinity during a commission of the crime. And I guess I want to get it on the record, because if you're in the vicinity, I mean, I'd like to know what that means. I mean, this is not people in their homes, or is it? Or is it people looking out windows, or is it? I mean, how broad is that language supposed to be? I mean, we don't want to, I don't want to see people having dragnets, and I doubt you do either.
Through the chair, Representative Kutula, I think you have to read that particular provision in the context of the other three requirements that are that a police officer must have established in order to detain a person. And I think the first one is that the person, the police officer knows the person witnessed the crime or was somewhere in the vicinity. But in addition to that, the officer has to know that has to have reasonable suspicion that the person has information of material aid in the investigation. The first provision says that you can only apply this to people who saw it or were near enough to know something about it. And in addition, you have to have reasonable suspicion that the person actually does have some information. So I don't think that this is, I guess, you know, you could ask the question this way. If the police are investigating a serious offense, they want to know what happened, why it happened, who was involved. They often have to make that determination very quickly in a matter of, for public safety. They aren't going to go far afield from the scene of the crime in order to make that determination. And this is simply a limitation on the police ability to go far from the scene of the crime. That was the language suggested by the legislative drafter, and frankly, I think that it's got to be applied with some common sense.
This was discussed at some length in judiciary, and there was a conversation about putting in the word immediate vicinity, and then the discussion occurred like the brown van, who was not in immediate vicinity, but by having been reported that there was a van leaving the scene, they were several blocks away before it was stopped. And of course, it was also pointed out that the response time is pretty quick for the police, but in 3-4 minutes it takes them to get there or whatever. If someone's running, they could be a block or two away as well. And if you say there's been a shooting and then there's someone running rapidly away, again, the common sense application. I certainly agree with Representative Kutula. This is not an attempt for a broad drag net or something where we just have blanket canvassing of a neighborhood. There has to, again, some professional discretion of the police officer.
Representative Stoltz?
Thanks.
Looking in Section 2 down a ways on line 24, it has the language about protection of crime victims from imminent harms. That's catches my attention. I appreciate that feature, and if maybe you can describe how that works. And secondly, is it could be interpreted sometimes even minors or others associated with, say, gang activity might also fall into the category of somebody that might be a victim of imminent harm, even though they weren't. They might have been, you know, involved with the group, but that because they were a witness, they were in harm. I don't know if I'd made myself. the point?
I'm afraid I don't understand here.
Okay. No. Just the scenario, say, a gang activity. There was a girlfriend of one of the members, maybe not an uninvolved party. She drove there with them, but as a witness, she's in threat. Is that, do they fall under the category potentially as somebody that could be protected as a victim?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stoltz, I'd refer you back to the scenario earlier where by requiring them to identify themselves, the police can go back and then have further discussions with them where they don't appear, it doesn't appear then that they're volunteering their participation, the police are requesting the participation, and it does provide them with some protection, and of course it also provides the police with the opportunity that information might be forthcoming now that wouldn't have been if it appeared that this person was volunteering to cooperate.
I'm looking at this as a good feature of protecting. It says temporary detention in order to protect a victim from imminent harm or other exigent circumstances. I wonder how long that could be.
And again, we've spent a good bit of time trying to discuss temporary, and maybe I can refer to Dean as far as the legal aspects of that.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, there is no, in this particular chapter, there is no definition of victim, but in the in Title 12 generally there is a definition of victim, which is used in the victim's rights statutes, which is someone who has actually been the victim of a crime. For this statute to apply, the police officer doesn't have to know as a matter of fact that the person was a victim, but just have reasonable suspicion that the person was a victim. And so I think it gives the police some latitude to take action to maybe even prevent something from occurring. There was a case in Alaska that got up to the Alaska Court of Appeals where the police had gotten a report that a woman was being beaten. The police didn't witness it themselves. They just had this report over the telephone. When they went to the scene, they saw a car with a woman and a man driving off at a high rate of speed. The woman appeared to be intoxicated. And under those circumstances, the Court of Appeals said, well, the police had reasonable suspicion to believe that that was the person that they had received the report on, that woman might be in danger, may have been the victim of a crime, and so the police were justified in pulling over that car to determine whether there was something going on, whether she was a witness to a crime or the victim. And the specific this specific statutory scheme is based at least partially on that case where the Court of Appeals actually had a victim in mind, and the police were responding to perceived needs of a victim. So I think you're right. I think it is a good thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I have any, I don't want to slow this down anymore. If I have any other questions, I'll catch these two good people in the hallway.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I might ask to be excused, there's another meeting at the other end of the hall, and they thought maybe I ought to be there to give them a hand or to slow them down, one or the other.
2 seconds, Mr. Chairman. Could I just ask one question?
Representative Holm?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Bundy, was there any discussions about the differential between adults and juveniles and how you're going to handle the information of juveniles more carefully?
I do not recall that, Mr. Chairman, that there was a... Remember, this material is main, or the if there has to be fingerprints or photographs, they are of a temporary nature, or the photographs are of temporary nature. So I have to defer to my extended memory, but I don't recall any discussion like that.
Good. Thank you, Mr.
If you'll excuse me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Testimony.
Okay. Was there anybody here who wanted to testify on this bill? Seeing none, anybody online? All right, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. Was there any amendments? No amendments? Okay, any other discussion? There's, looks like, zero fiscal notes. So, zero fiscal notes, no amendments, no questions, Rips and Foster.
Yes, sir. And I wanted to thank the staff here for this bill. I know you did a lot of work on it. I'll go ahead and move SB 206 out of committee with attached fiscal notes with individual recommendations.
Mr. Chairman, this is a note. There is an indeterminate fiscal note.
Oh, indeterminate, okay.
Mr. Chairman.
An indeterminate. All right, with the, we'll go ahead and pass this up on with the attached fiscal notes. See no objection, the bill passes committee. Okay, thank you very much. All right, we'll go ahead and take up House Bill 316. Let's see, is this your bill, Representative Stoltz?
In sponsorship, yes, sir.
Okay, Representative Stoltz.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman. Put in the bill to introduce, to extend the Bar Association Board of Governors. I originally put in a bill for 3 years. The audit hadn't come out. It had a different sunset date. This bill was discussed at the Judiciary Chairman and members of that committee had a lot of contentious issues they wanted to discuss, but because of the late date in the session, they wanted to have an opportunity to look at substantive issues, but not have those delayed for so many years out. So it was the judgment of the previous committee chairman and her members to extend it for one additional year and give the next legislature an opportunity to review those issues next year in the sunset review. And it's basically as simple as that. I don't have any special provisions or any other features in here. It's just a direct extension. And the time extension for the reasons stated.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Stoltz? Okay. Seeing none. I'm sorry. Representative Couture.
Did the Board of Governors respond on about the 1 year, or have any different requests, or are they accepting the 1 year?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know I didn't talk to them directly. I know they're very worried about it being extended and not going into a sunset wind down. I'm looking at the date we're at, and I think. They wanted 8 years. Most boards want as many as possible, and there were a number of substantive issues. So I agreed with the co-chairman of judiciary, or the chairman of judiciary, excuse me, that much better to address those issues in a timely manner in both bodies rather than just one. But we can go whichever way. I'd rather have a measured time response. And a lot of public participation.
Okay. Anything else? All right. Is there anybody here in Juneau who wants to testify on this particular bill? Okay. Let's see. We'll go online. It looks like we do have one person. Dr. Obermeyer, are you with us? Okay. Teresa?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Representative Meyer and members of the Finance Committee, I would have much preferred to be with you, but you're not going to believe it. We have spent all of our money at the Alaska Bar Association for the last 22 years. I just want to mention that I think everyone in the state knows what could have been possible. We're supposed to live in the United States, Representative Meyer. I don't think you can imagine our desperation. We now understand that the bar results are supposed to come out on Wednesday, May 10th. Now, I really commend the Judiciary Committee for only giving a one-year extension. And I really hope that you will, out of respect for your own Judiciary Committee, agree with that. If it had been up to me, I absolutely believe the Alaska Bar Association should be sunset. They have two responsibilities. The first is licensure. We are absolutely positive that getting an Alaska law license is only based on favoritism. So that we know that one isn't fair. Then the other one is discipline. And I can give you a long list of people who are licensed attorneys that have actually been convicted in Alaska courts of law that have not even had their names on the agenda of the Board of Governors. I just, you know, just Craig Winky. You know, there was an editorial in Friday's Anchorage Daily News that it is the legislature's fault that you have not created an ethics bill. It absolutely is not your fault. It should have been the Alaska Bar Association that disciplined or disbarred former Attorney General Craig Winky. Instead, he's still licensed. He can represent any person that he chooses to and go to court. So let's figure this out now. Representative Meyer, if you'd like me to, I'd be glad to mention a few names. There is Bob Ely, who has been convicted in Anchorage Federal Court of a criminal act and has not even been disciplined. There's Mitch Bravo, who has been convicted in Superior Court.
Dr. Obermeyer.
Yes, sir.
Leave the names out, please.
Sir, but see, these are court cases.
Just stay on
the court. Would you always forgive me, Representative Meyer? Attorneys are officers of the court. They are supposed to be public figures. And so, sir, they're not like a private citizen. They're supposed to be leading ethics and justice in our state. And that never seems to happen. I'd like to simply mention that I would like to lead by example myself individually. I have tried in a fair-minded way. I have navigated through everything that has been pulled on me by innumerable judges and attorneys in the state. I'm very proud to report I have weathered individually in a marriage 17 fabricated court charges. Kevin, I don't know when you know, I have actually been acquitted in a 7-day jury trial that was made up against me. Can you imagine how much that costs? So, Kevin, I hope we do know that the Obermeyers are trying, hope against hope, to simply be fair. We love our state. Let's realize we live in a 47-year-old frontier, and Kevin, we live, and just so we remember, in the only state in the United States that does not have a law school, we live in the only state in the United States that has no elected attorney, and we live in the only state in the United States that a bar association does not require continuing legal education. You know, it's always a discussion, but it never changes. So I truly can commend Liesl McGuire, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, Representative Coghill, Representative Wilson, and Representative Cox, that they showed enough leadership that they simply believe there needs to be better communication with the Alaska legislature. I just assumed you have people coming to you all the time with problems about licensure and discipline and what goes on when they try to have, when they have legal matters. It is so good that there would only be a 1-year renewal. That creates a lot of discussion and communication. I really ask for that, and I really pledge individually that I am going to follow this very actively and help in any way that I can. But lastly, we're just hoping that after 22 years, my husband can finally be licensed on Wednesday. As you might know, Representative Meyer, my husband has been licensed for 16 years in a state that has reciprocity with Alaska, that's the state of Missouri. And as we have watched in desperation, the Alaska Bar Association has licensed almost 20% of the licensed attorneys in Alaska. That's 550 out of 2,900. or active out of state.
Okay, Teresa, your time's up. I've
sure.
let you go over here.
Did you have any questions, Representative
Miles? I believe, in summary, you support the bill. Is that correct?
Yes, of course, and okay. I truly commend Representative McGuire.
All right, well, we'll pass that on to her.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. All right, anyone else who wants to testify? Okay, is anyone else online? Okay, very good. We'll go ahead and close public testimony.
Let's see. This had a zero fiscal note also, I believe, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Is there any amendments? Representative Weber.
In light of the testimony, I wonder if the sponsor is open for an extension.
Yeah. Or a sunset?
Of 2007 to 2008.
Okay, I think your bill's a good bill, Representative Stoltz.
Mr. Chairman, I would respect the, I was happy that the Judiciary Chairman agreed to move it on with that provision, and that would bring it right to the head at the beginning of next year. We just had so many other issues, somehow this slipped back, and I will also, for the record, I'm going to be sure to pass along the concerns to the next Senate chairman, Senator Seekins, and the finance people about the concerns of this bill and present them through public testimony.
Okay.
Very good. Representative Hawkins.
On the fiscal note, sir?
Yes.
I will comment this is one of the more unusual fiscal notes I've seen in my tenure in the legislature. I've seen zeros before, but typically on our boards and commissions, obviously the legislature has certain it's a receipt-supported service activity and expenditure. The analysis here that the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar Association is not allocated to a department and considers itself exempt from the appropriation powers of the legislature is rather interesting.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, that's one of the issues we want to have time to address in committee, among others, at least to analyze those.
So as we pass this out, I would just like it to be with on the record that we note the fiscal note, but it identifies an issue that is in dispute.
Okay, anything else? Okay, Representative Foster.
Yes, sir. I'll go ahead and move HB 316 out of the Finance Committee with the attached fiscal notes with individual recommendations.
Okay, any objections? Seeing none, that bill passes the committee. Okay, let's go on now to the capital budget. We have that Senate Bill 231. And what I'd like to do here is go ahead and take the public testimony now. And then we're going to break after public testimony is done. I believe we have a floor session at 2 o'clock-ish. And then what I'd like is, if there's amendments, that perhaps the amendments can be working while we're on the floor. I think we're going to be on the floor a while today. So if we could have all the amendments by 4:30, 5 o'clock, would that work for Senator Krueger?
I kind of like the bill.
Good. Well, that'd be nice. Maybe we won't have any amendments. I just want to make sure there's plenty of time. Look,
thank you.
Obviously, the sooner we can get them, the better, so we can make copies and get them to all the members. All right, so I'm going to ask my staff, Mr. Eklund, to join us and kind of give us a brief overview of what's in the CS. Could I have a motion to adopt the House Finance Committee substitute?
We would adopt House CS for CS for Senate Bill Number 231, Finance 24-GS2034/X-Kane-57-2006 of the working document from the Finance Committee.
Very good. Any objections? Seeing none, we have that before us. Mr. Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Peter Eklund, staff to Co-Chairman Meyer. Let's kind of give a brief high-level overview of the adopted CS you have in front of you, Mr. Chairman. Probably many of you are aware that the Senate has some language in there that would appropriate $182 million to PCE. The House
has added similar language that would appropriate $73 million for the top three schools on the school construction list in FY07. And also, in FY08, we would appropriate approximately $90 million to the next schools on the list, numbers 4 through 8. And that was in response to the passage, or the hopefully the very soon passage of House Bill 13, the school construction bonding legislation for urban schools, Mr. Chairman. Also contained in the CS is municipal energy assistance, approximately $66.6 million, with a spread amongst municipalities based on population. There's a $40,000 minimum payment to each municipality. And also, Mr. Chairman, there are payments for the increased cost in PERS in FY07 for municipalities, approximately $18.8 million. And just note, Mr. Chairman, that those payments would be deducted from what a community would expect under the energy assistance and deposited into their retirement accounts for them. Also, you'll see in the bill appropriations for $170 million approximately of tobacco bond projects. That bill, House Bill 381, is, I believe, on the Senate floor and maybe reconsideration today, expected to pass. Mr. Chairman, in all total FY07 capital is about $2.3 billion. And it's kind of a macro overview, Mr. Chairman.
Before we go to questions, the three rural schools that are being that are in the capital budget are, if I recall, New Stoyac, which is Rep. St. Moses District, Lower Kuskokwim, which I think would be Rep. St. Kapsner's, and then Noatak, which is Rep. St. Jules. And then going on down the list, 3 through 8, that's effective. We have the date on that is July 1st, 07, correct?
Mr. Chairman, projects 4 through 8, that is correct, July 1st of calendar year 07.
Okay, and that picks up schools, I believe, in Representative Foster's district, as well as Representative Salmon, and I don't remember the others. Okay, so in other words, what we want to do is go down the major maintenance list for rural schools down to number 8, with 3 being started next year.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman, and that's in response to the passage of House Bill 13, the school bond debt reimbursement bill.
Right, which was the 70-30 for the urban schools. Yeah, okay.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. And then, yes, any questions? Okay, the only thing I would encourage members to do is read the language sections in the capital budget, because some of this information that Mr. Eklund is mentioning is in the language section itself and not in the number section. Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If I might add,
if everybody in the building would have their staff and themselves look at the bill and just look for any technical corrections we might need to make or that type of thing, Mr. Chairman, that would be helpful for us.
So you're saying we did this last night at 4:30 in the morning that you might have made a typing error or something?
That's possible, Mr. Chairman, yes. It's probable.
Okay. Very good. Fair enough. All right. There's no questions. Let's go ahead and go right into public testimony. We do have some people online. We have some people here, I believe. Let's go online first. Art Sweets. And I will limit the testimony just because we do have several people to approximately 2 minutes. Mr. Weeks?
Yes, sir.
You want to
good afternoon, Representative Meyer and members of the committee. My name is Art Weeks. I'm municipal librarian for the municipality of Anchorage and the Anchorage Municipal Libraries. All my life, I feel like I've been tipping at windmills as a librarian. I feel like I'm doing so again today. But let's go. I know that missing from the SB 231 is the project of the Anchorage Municipal Library, specifically $1.8 million for LUSAC renovations and $1.5 million for the Girdwood Library projects. I just want to hopefully reach you today to tell you the urgency of these projects. The renovations to the Lusac Library has as its centerpiece the need to create a teen space, a safe and healthy environment for which teens can come to the library and study and socialize. This would move the teens away from the young children, the elementary school age, and the toddlers into their own space, which would be more appropriate to their needs. We're also consolidating a lot of services to enable us to serve with a diminished staff. It's pretty well known to the people in Anchorage that we don't have the number of people serving that we used to, but we've come up with creative solutions of putting like services together to create less staffing stations and a way that we can actually provide as good, if not better, library service than before. And also the Lusac Library, and in its 20 years, is starting to deteriorate, and there's money for repair. So we're hoping that somewhere that can still be considered before the end of the session. Secondly, the Girdwood Project has received very, very strong support from the community. In past bond votes, as much as 70% of the people in the Girdwood precinct that voted yes for this, only to have it turned down in area-wide votes. We've been going at this for 10 years, but we're getting close. We have some money. The people of Girdwood themselves have put up $1 million to this project. We have a little bit of money from last year. We are looking for $1.5 million this year. And with the grants to do the balance, we think we can bring this project home and hopefully cut the ribbon on this as soon as possible. So that's my testimony, Representative Meyer, and committee, and I appreciate having this opportunity to speak to you today. Thank you very much.
Ms. Quick, we do have a quick question for you. Sure. Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, a correction, Mr. Weeks. I believe you indicated you were still struggling to get particularly the Girdwood portion into the bill. I'm pleased to say, very happy to say that is now in this bill that is before us.
Thank you very much, Representative Hawker. We thank you.
You have a very strong advocate on the Finance Committee for that library.
And we're very appreciative, and the people of Girdwood are appreciative.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Weeks. All right, let's go on now to Lynn McNamara.
It's McNamara, sir.
Yes, go ahead, Lynn.
Hi, my name is Lynn McNamara. I'm a resident of Girdwood, and I am on the Girdwood Library Community Center Task Force. And I just wanted to thank all of you. I was in touch with Mike Hawker's office staff this morning when we found that it was on the bill, and I wanted to thank particularly Mike Hawker, but also you, Mr. Meyer, and everyone on the Finance Committee. It's been something that we found because of the political process. We were finding it was impossible to do with the regular bonding process, and so the state support is so important for this. I know that you have a lot of things to do, and I won't take up any more of your time except to tell you that we are heartily grateful, and that we will continue to work on getting other grants and taxing ourselves to make this a reality. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Lynn, and thank you for your testimony. And yes, your representative is working hard here on your behalf in the community of Girdwood. Okay, let's go on to here in Juneau.
I thought he was supporting the person supporting the libraries was Representative Foster.
Well, yeah, Representative Foster supports libraries too, yes. Okay, Rich Poore.
Long time sitting here.
Yeah. Welcome, Rich.
Thank you. Again, my name's Rich Poore. I'm a 60-year resident of Juneau. Worked for DOT for 31 years and mostly as a transportation planner. My testimony is in support of keeping the $45 million for Juneau Access in House Bill 231. The following comments that I will make are facts and not myths. You have been told by the opposition that cutting the money-making runs Upland Canal would cost the ferry system an additional $2.3 to $3.6 million annually, resulting in decreased ferry service to other communities. This is not true. Upland Canal is not a money-maker, not a money-making run. In fact, no runs on the Alaska Marine Highway System are money makers. In fiscal year 2004, it cost $11.7 million to provide Lynn Canal service. Revenues were $6 million, leaving a net loss to the state of $5.7 million. If Lynn Canal service were completely eliminated, Alaska Marine Highway System revenues system-wide would be reduced to $6 million, but the total cost to the state would be reduced by $11.7 million annually. We have been told that building the road will result in longer and less predictable travel times. This is not true. Not counting the time it takes to make early reservations and pay for tickets months in advance, highway system requires that vehicles traveling on a state ferry arrive at the ferry terminal 2 hours before departure. That means that the loading, traveling, and unloading time in Haines on a mainline ferry takes 7.1 hours, and on the fast ferry, if it's running, 4.5 hours. These facts, and anyone that travels the ferry knows, pardon me, these are facts, and anyone that travels the ferry knows the rules. The general access road will take 2.5 hours to travel to Haines. There is no required wait time to get on a shuttle ferry because it is on a first-come, first-served basis. And there will be several runs throughout the day between the Katzenhain Ferry Terminal and Haines, as versus just once a day on the existing Alaska Marine Highway System. You have been told it will cost the state 45% more to maintain the proposed road than the existing ferry system. This is not true. The no action alternative identified in the EIS is not the same system that is currently operating in Lynn Canal. In 2004, it cost the state $5.7 million to operate the current Alaska Marine Highway System in Lynn Canal. If you amortize this cost over a 30-year period, the total cost to the state would be $171 million. The proposed road will cost the state only $88 million over the same time period, and that cost includes a state match to leverage federal dollars for the construction of the project. There is no state match for federal dollars for the no-action alternative because there are no future capital costs associated for replacing the existing ferries. In fact, all the no-action alternative does is run the existing ferries into the graveyard with no replacement costs factored in. We have been told that building the Juneau Access Project will come at the expense of other transportation projects. This is not true. In 2007 STIP, the Juneau Access Project does not affect any of the projects that the opposition cites. The final EIS describes the different sources of funding necessary to construct the Juneau Access.
You can wrap up, please.
Okay. Again, I just urge you to support keeping the $45 million in House Bill 231.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony today. Okay. Merrill Stanford.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just here to answer any questions. Thank you.
On
the road access.
On the road access. Okay. Very good. Thank you. If you want to tell us, are you for or against?
For
the road. For the road. Okay. All right. Very good. Jim Becker.
I'm also here to answer any questions. I'm for the road. I represent the seafood industry.
Very good. Thank you. I like that testimony. Richard Knapp.
Yes, sir. I'm here also to answer any questions. And I am also in favor of the Juneau Access.
Okay, he's cut the road too. Very good.
He was a DOT commissioner.
All right. Kevin Ritchie. I assume you're not here to talk about the Juneau Road.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Kevin Ritchie with the Alaska Municipal League. On behalf of all of our members, all of your constituents, I'd like to thank you very much for your hard work on the CS on behalf of your communities and each one of your constituents. What is in the CS for communities is going to mean lower taxes and otherwise for citizens and businesses. It's going to help our small cities survive another year, which is very important. It's going to allow our communities to better deal with some of the remaining school issues that always exist. And finally, it's a very good step towards really meeting the PERS and TERS issue that we all have. And especially, I want to thank you also for House Bill 375, which was another great long-term step. But anyway, I want to thank you very much, and that's all my testimony.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Ritchie. Any questions for Mr. Ritchie? Okay. You're fine?
Okay.
Thanks. Actually, I think that's all on my list. Is there somebody else? Okay.
We may have some people signing up there, too.
Okay. Mr. Siebert, Orrin Siebert with the Alaska Aviation Museum. Mr. Siebert.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
And ladies and gentlemen of the House Finance Committee, thanks for the opportunity. Just been watching you on TV, and I thought I'd try and call in. Anyway, the Alaska Aviation Museum, located on Lake Hood, I stepped in about 5 or 6 years ago, and over the last couple, 3 years, we've made such tremendous progress, particularly the last year. We got funding from Rasmussen Foundation, Murdoch Foundation. We now have 3 full-time employed management people, an executive director, a marketing director, and a curator. They only started last April, so last summer was already pretty much, you know, done. But so far, they raised the museum attendance from 3,000 the year before to 11,000 last year, and we're looking at 20,000 this year. And I just really, I and the entire board just really believe in the importance of preserving and presenting this Alaskan aviation heritage for the general public. And so our request is in for $750,000, which you people originally approved, and then it got cut way down in the Senate. So if you could just reconsider, we really need that money, and we will put it to good use. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Siebert, and I know you probably don't have a copy of it, although I think it is available online. It has been restored to the $750,000 level.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you very much.
I think this committee's desire is to keep it at that level. But in return, we'd like to keep Representative Samuels for a couple more months.
That's a deal. I'm getting tired of looking at it.
We'll pass that on to it.
Yeah. All right.
We do have a question. Representative Weiler?
Yes.
Well, it's my kid that wonders why you have your own TV show, Mr. Chairman, but I was wondering, we had put some money in for restoration of Governor Hammond's airplane. Do you have any connection at all with that?
Well, I've talked to that group, and I think they're, frankly, I think they're very naive, and they're not asking for near enough money. It's going to take way more money than $235,000 to restore that airplane. And we have it in our possession, but of course it does belong to the state. And I've talked to Bruce Cotto and tried to get him to commit to leaving it on us. I mean, Jay Hammond has been my personal friend since I was 14 years old. But his history is all in Bristol Bay and Lake Clark. That airplane belongs in Anchorage. And I'm happy to work with that group if they want to contribute. But the airplane needs to be here so everybody can see it.
Okay, very good. Thank you for joining us today, Mr.
Well, thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
Okay, good luck, you guys.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Let's see, was there anyone else online? Okay. Has anybody else signed up that I don't have on the list? Go ahead, Ms. Bruce. I think Lance gave me a new list, but go ahead, Paul.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Foose representing the Kuskokwim Corporation, and I apologize for the lateness of this request, but when I explain it, I hope you'll understand. 2 weeks ago, we held a meeting in Aniak with all the villages of the Middle Kuskokwim area to consider formation of a borough, and part of it was also in support of the Donlin Creek mining effort, and the mine stated at the meeting, and has stated since, they really need a local government there to make a tax arrangement with, so they have some certainty so that they can move forward with the mine. We couldn't really make the request until the local people had indicated an interest in looking at a borough. At that meeting, they did form an exploratory committee to come up with a draft borough plan and application to the local boundary commission. All of this was sponsored by the Kuskokwim Corporation, the Village Corporation, and the area. It cost them about $40,000 to bring everybody together. that the step that is really necessary for them to move forward is a borough feasibility study, and according to the department, that will cost about $60,000. So we have worked closely with the department. They did send their personnel out there, and Placer Dome Barrick was also there, and we had a good response from the people. So we are requesting $60,000 to move ahead with that borough formation application. And again, I apologize for the lateness of it. We just could not get out ahead of the people until they had made the statement that they were interested.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Foose. Yeah, I've got it written down here. We may need to get some more information from you. Perhaps you can give that to.
I do have a written report on.
Yeah, if you give that to Mr. Eklund, and then we'll consider it tonight when we do amendments.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. did you have a question? I'm sorry, Representative Foster.
No.
Okay.
So I wanted to thank Mr. Hughes, though. I know he's been working real hard with that. Organize some self-governance there, and I hope we can help.
Where is this? I'm sorry.
Out of Antioch.
I should know.
Mr. Chairman, the area is in the middle, the area of the middle of the Kuskokwim River. It goes from the lower Kalskags up to Antioch, Stony River, Lyme, and Crooked Creek is the area where the mine actually is, about 20 miles inland there. This is the model borough boundaries identified by the local boundary commission. It's called the Cusbuck region, and it includes the Cusbuck School District. So okay. The school district was there, and the nonprofit Native Association, everyone was in attendance.
Very good. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go on now to Emery Ferry. I don't know if I got the name right. Oh, there you are. Okay.
Thank you very much. Again, it's Emily Ferry with the Alaska Transportation Priorities Project. And the Juneau Road issue, I'm sure that you are all aware how controversial the issue is here in Juneau. I'm also sure that you're aware that we've all limited testimony today. I don't know that there will ever be consensus in this town on that issue, and you guys, more than anyone, probably know that. There was one thing that I did want to point out today. This is from the Record of Decision issued by the Federal Highway Administration. In the Record of Decision, they say, verbatim, based on the current funding proposal, Alternative 2B, which again is the shuttle ferry, road shuttle ferry option, Alternative 2B would have a net state cost over 35 years of $122 million, approximately double that of the no-action alternative. Again, approximately double that of the no-action alternative. In other words, if we leave well enough alone in the Lynn Canal, the state will save $61 million. They go on to explain that the higher net cost of Alternative 2B is due primarily to the state match required for federal construction funds, part of which is included in the capital budget that you are discussing today, and the state's decision to use $57.5 million in state funds to supplement the federal funds rather than using the maximum possible federal assistance. Had the state opted to fund the project with federal funds to the maximum extent, state costs would have been $88 million, as reported in the final EIS. So again, I just wanted to repeat, there may be valid reasons for building a road halfway up the Lynn Canal, but the idea that the state will save money doing this is simply not one of them. I'll be happy to leave this record of decision with you. And again, I just wanted to make sure everyone was aware that this move will actually double the amount of money that we're going to have to put into this project. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe you can give a copy to Joyce there. We'll respond and we can get it later. Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Okay, Tom Price.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep it short. I know you guys need to get on the floor here. My name's Tom Bryce. I'm a Juneau resident, had been a Fairbanks resident for about 20 years prior to moving to Juneau. I just want to express my support for the $45 million that is put in for Juneau access.
I think that represents a significant addition to the state's transportation portfolio, and it's a very good progressive action to create access for more Alaskans to the state's capital, as well as helping out the economy of Southeast Alaska. Thank you very much for your efforts on that, and that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Any questions for Tom? Okay. Very good. Thank you, Tom. Anyone else join online? Okay. Anyone else signed up? Where's Glenn? Hello. Joyce, is there anyone else that we?
I'm sorry, sir.
I'll just ask. Anybody in the audience yet that wants to testify? That. Okay. Well, we'll give a minute here to just make sure. All right. Okay, we'll go ahead and close public testimony then. At this time, what I'd like to do is just go ahead and give members time to take another look at the budget, read it over, and come up with any amendments that you may have so that we can have them in our office by 4:30-ish. And we'll take up amendments tonight, and depending on how many we have, hopefully pass this on to the floor tonight. Also, it's going to obviously be contingent on how long we're on the floor this afternoon. So, with that, then let's just stand at ease until the call of the chair sometime this evening. Okay, so we're at ease, I guess. That's right, we're good. At ease for 4 hours.